This is WNUT Talk on the WNUT Radio Network.
You are listening to WNUT Talk. I am Brandon, a.k.a. Stoney, and today, oh my God, I've got a treat for you. I've got a topic that is very near and dear to my heart that I've been wanting to do for several months on WNUT Talk, and I'm not going to waste a lot of your time, you know, promoting WNUT and telling you where to go find more and all that shit. I'm just going to say, welcome to WNUT Talk. Thank you for joining us. If you're kind of new to WNUT Talk, if you haven't heard a lot of these, man, we will just tackle whatever's on my mind, whether it's a music related topic, whether it's, you know, we've done an episode where we had a roundtable discussion ruining your favorite movies and TV shows. That was a lot of fun. We've had interviews with rock stars on this show. Sometimes I just talk about, you know, digging through the local record store. It literally is just whatever is kind of fascinating me at that moment, something that I want to discuss, the history of a particular thing that I don't see covered a lot, you know. And today I have one of those. And it's something that, like I said, it's near and dear to me. I hope that I can interest you in it and make you go and seek out some of this stuff. And today, I am talking about the partnership between musician Meatloaf and songwriter Jim Steinman. That is right, the powerhouse collaboration between these two, which produced not just the Bat Out of Hell albums. That's what people know. People, when you mention Meatloaf, when you mention Jim Steinman, or the two together especially, people are going to talk about Bat Out of Hell 1 and 2. But the partnership they had together spanned so many more years and was responsible for so much more music. And I want to discuss that, and I want to take you through it, and I want to hopefully have the bug bite you, and then you run and listen to more of this stuff and seek out so much more from not just the work they did together, but I'm just a Steinman fan, and I hope that I can kind of get you on board on the Steinman bandwagon. But anyway, let's get right to it. Meatloaf was born Marvin Lee Adday, though he would go by Michael, on September 27th, 1947, and James Richard Steinman was born a month later on November 1st, 1947, and these two men's careers would be very closely intertwined, whether at times they liked it or not, for more than 40 years. And so we'll start with Steinman. He's the maestro here, the songwriter, the man who put the words in Meatloaf's mouth, along with countless other performers throughout the years who we'll get to. We'll talk about some of those and some of the songs that they made famous. But, you know, mostly we're focusing on Meatloaf and Steinman together here today. So at Amherst College in Massachusetts, Steinman got into writing music for some of that school's productions of plays by Bertolt Brecht. And he even directed some theater himself. And as a senior project, he wrote and scored an original rock and roll musical called The Dream Engine in 1969, which the Dream Engine created a little controversy at that school. It had some explicit subject matter. There was a little matter of onstage nudity. But again, it was 1969, so I mean, you know, the hippie movement's in full swing. People are kind of desensitized a bit at that point to some of these things. But again, you're not going to get away with things like that without some discussion, some rabble-rousing and things like that. And so the Dream Engine, not only did it contain some controversy, but it was full of metaphors and allegory and social commentary. And like some of Steinman's better-known later work, it did leave audiences kind of confused as to the meaning. And, you know, they were dazzled by the spectacle, but there was a lot of what does this mean or how do we interpret this? And you'll see that continue as Steinman goes on through the years, writing things and publishing work and, you know, having his words and his music in the public space. And so the Dream Engine was actually set to be the opening performance at New York's Newman Theater in 1970. Steinman had gotten involved with a guy named Joseph Papp, who directed the New York Shakespeare Festival, and he really believed in Steinman. He kind of wanted to back him, and he kind of wanted to bring his work to more people. And they had worked out an arrangement for this show to be the one that opened that theater, but for whatever reason, they decided that the theater didn't do justice to that production. Now, I couldn't necessarily find like what the reasoning was for that. Like, was the space not big enough? Did it not kind of have the technical capability to do some of the things they wanted to do? I don't really know. But keep the Dream Engine in mind, because all the way to the end of today's episode, we will be coming back to that, although it won't always be known as the Dream Engine. So anyway, they would try again the following year in Washington, D.C., and Richard Gere was actually attached to play the lead. But again, The Dream Engine was canceled in 1972 because creative differences between Steinman and his director at that time, Richard Perlman, kind of, you know, came up and caused some problems. And if anyone could have been a miracle worker, it was Perlman, because he had opened the first production of The Who's Tommy in Seattle in 1971, starring a young Bette Midler. Actually, hold that thought for a second. We'll get back to Bette. But he couldn't work the miracles that he needed to with the Dream Engine, and it just, you know, it kept stalling and it kept not happening. But Steinman was determined, man. He got a break because a song that he'd written got recorded and released by Yvonne Elliman, who audiences might know from playing Mary Magdalene in the film version of Jesus Christ Superstar, the Andrew Lloyd Webber musical. So Yvonne Elliman records a song that Steinman had written called Happy Ending on her 1973 album Food of Love. And this is Steinman's first commercially released song. Though I got to tell you, listening to it today, it does not sound like Steinman as we think of his work. We think of him as very bombastic and theatrical. He is often described as Wagnerian, you know, Wagner the composer, the very just epic and grandiose. This is not that. But, you know, he's out there. He's finally getting songs published and recorded. But I'll tell you, something I didn't know existed until I was preparing this episode. Something more impressive, in my opinion, is an unreleased demo from 1972 that's floating around out there of a 26-year-old Bette Midler singing Heaven Can Wait, which sounds very much like a Steinman song, unlike Happy Ending. And Bette Midler recorded Heaven Can Wait at the Hit Factory in New York with Michael Kamen producing. And like I said, it was just a demo. The hope was that Steinman and Joseph Papp, who we talked about before, they were going to take these demos out and attract a new director for the Dream Engine with them. They were going to play these demos to people and wow them, and it just didn't happen, man. Steinman had been reworking the Dream Engine a bit for Broadway, and like I said, he really wanted to make it happen, but we'll talk about what eventually does happen. For now, just know it was not meant to be for the Dream Engine. As for Heaven Can Wait, though, while we were not destined to know the Bette Midler version, that song would go on to be prominently featured on the first Bat Out of Hell album, which would be the thing that launched both Jim Steinman and Meatloaf into the stratosphere. So anyway, that song is going to go on to great heights. Bette Midler would release her debut album later in 72 called The Divine Miss M as she transitioned from the stage to a recording career. And The Divine Miss M would be certified platinum in 1990. So, I mean, the path she took worked out just fine, I think. And decades of hits and starring roles in movies and plenty of returns to the stage. But listening to the demo, I can't help but wonder what she'd have sounded like taking on some other Jim Steinman songs, like Making Love Out of Nothing at All, or It Just Won't Quit. I really like the demo. It's just a different take on the song. It's nothing that's going to like knock you to the floor or anything, but I mean, God, it's a really cool take. And even though you recognize her voice, it's just so different. It's so much younger, and the dynamics are so much different than what she would go on to develop and embrace in her own performing, you know, in later years. So I was listening to it on the way back from a show last night and just kind of being wowed by it all over again. I encourage you to go look it up. It's on YouTube. You can check it out and hear it for yourself. But like I said, those demos did not attract a new director. It was not meant to be. And by 73, the Dream Engine just kind of stalled. And Steinman and Papp shifted focus to a new show that Jim was developing called Souvenirs, though it would actually open under the title More Than You Deserve. Now, let's put a bookmark right there, because that is an important page, and we're going to come back to it. But, ding, the oven is done, and Meatloaf is ready. I know that's cheesy as fuck. I'm sorry. I've always been cheesy. Anybody who knows me will tell you that. So, Marvin Lee Adey, who went by Michael, he played football in middle school, and by the seventh grade, he was 5'2" and 240 pounds. So, somewhere in those years, he picked up the nickname Meatloaf, either from his teammates or there's actually a story that he stepped on his coach's foot and his coach says, "Hey, man, get off my foot, you big hunk of meatloaf." And so either there or his, you know, whatever it was, people started calling him Meatloaf and he embraced it. He loved the name and he kind of made it part of his persona. And by high school, the music bug had bitten Meatloaf and he started appearing in some musical stage productions like Where's Charlie and The Music Man. So Step Aside Hugh Jackman. And he played defensive tackle on the football team. So he could sing and he could move like a son of a bitch. And those two things would make him pretty valuable on the stage. So high school gives way to college, and he went to North Texas State, but after some drama with his stepfather, he dropped out and he moved to Los Angeles. And by the time he was 21, Meatloaf had put a band together. And Meatloaf's band, they go on to open for everybody from Van Morrison to The Who to The Stooges and even The Grateful Dead. But Meatloaf said that no matter what he achieved in music, he felt at that time that he was treated kind of like a circus clown in the industry, likely because he didn't resemble your typical heartthrob rock star with the chiseled appearance and the whatever. He had his own charisma for sure, but he just was a different look that people were not accustomed to at that time. You know, there were no jelly rolls in music in, you know, 1969, 1970 or whatever. So he finds himself getting back into musical theater to make a little money. And he appeared in Hair, where he met Sean Murphy, also known as Stoney. And let me tell you, if she is still using that name today, she's going to hear from my attorneys, goddammit. But Meatloaf and Stoney would release an album together in 1971 called Stoney and Meatloaf. So now Meatloaf has an album out there, and it's charting. Its lead single goes to number 36 on the Soul Singles chart and number 71 on the Billboard Hot 100. But, you know, he, despite the successes that he's having, he still can't get taken seriously by the music business and by the press. So Meatloaf moves around the country. He plays small venues. He gets back into theater, and he winds up in New York, and he appears in Rainbow. He rejoins the cast of Hair. This time he plays it on Broadway. And then he auditions for this new show that's debuting called Souvenirs, which was written by two guys named Michael Weller and Jim Steinman. Boom! See, we're back on the page we bookmarked earlier. I am a visionary. I told you. Trust me, baby. I got you. I'm in the captain's seat. I'm going to guide you through this musical partnership. So now, Meatloaf auditions for a minor part in the show Souvenirs, but Steinman was blown away by what he heard, and he insisted that they find a featured solo for Meatloaf to perform in that production. So along comes a song called More Than You Deserve, and he has Weller write a new scene to justify the song in the moment, and voila, Meatloaf has a featured solo so powerful that by the time it opens, the whole show has been renamed More Than You Deserve. So, did they ever work together again? Did this partnership between Jim Steinman and Meatloaf last? Stick around and we'll find out right here on WNUT Talk.
Hey, what do we got here? The ghost with the most. I mean, I can't say my name. You know, it's the B word and everything. But hey, I just want to say you're listening to WNUT. Hey, we really like it down here in the afterlife. You know what I'm saying? Oh my God, them guys are so funny. Anyway, listen. Hey, I got to go, man. I just want to stop by and say, hey, you're listening to WNUT. So keep it up.
Best music, best talk, WNUT.
You're back on WNUT Talk with me, Brandon, a.k.a. Stoney, and we are talking about Jim Steinman and Meatloaf, in particular their musical partnership, their collaboration through the years. And, you know, like I said, when we started the show, it is so much more than Bat Out of Hell, although that's the way that I came to know their music in 1993. Bat Out of Hell 2 was on the charts. It was, I mean, on fire. And when I first heard Meatloaf's name, I thought it was ridiculous. In the age of Guns N' Roses, Metallica, Nirvana, Soundgarden, here's a guy named Meatloaf. I was like, what the hell is this? And so then I learned, you know, kind of who he was and what he had done. I was like, this is my mom's music. You know, I'm not interested in this. But wait, so was Aerosmith, and I loved Aerosmith. And I'll tell you, there was something about the songs from Bat Out of Hell 2 that I was hearing that I really liked. It was like rock and roll that I kind of hid from my friends for some reason. The first time I ever learned what a guilty pleasure was when Bat Out of Hell 2 was, you know, something that I liked, but my friends were into harder stuff. They were listening to Metallica, so was I, but they were not listening to Meatloaf, and I was. And then slowly I learned that more of my friends liked it too than I realized. Yeah, there were some who did not. And that was fine. But I also had this compilation from Time Life. And let me tell you, there was a time, if you don't remember, back in the before times, you used to see you'd be watching television, and during the commercial break, there would be a commercial for like a record or a CD or something that brought together all the hits you knew and loved from a particular time. And like KTEL Records was a record label that loved putting these things out, and that's how they made their damn money. They would just license these songs and then sell them to you on compilations. It's just basically like, you know, the one song you loved by whatever artist, and then there would be 20 or 30 of them, right? So I had seen one called Rock Dreams, and it had all these like,
you know, kind of pop rock hits and ballads from, I would say, the mid-70s through about the early 90s. Because it had stuff like Bad Company and Rick Springfield and like Survivor and Roxette and even Richard Marx. I mean, you know, stuff like that. So one of the songs on there is Meatloaf's 2 Out of 3 Ain't Bad, which, like I said, I was familiar with the Bat 2 stuff. I hear that song. And all the liner notes said about it was, you know, it was a Jim Steinman song. It had the writing credit, the copyright info for the 1977 date that it was released. And I was like, okay, this must be the first Bat Out of Hell. And so I start putting the, you know, pieces together, and I realized I might want to hear more of that one. I might want to hear more of the first Bat Out of Hell. So let's get back to that. After More Than You Deserve, after Meatloaf appeared in that show, and that show closed in early 74, Steinman revised the Dream Engine into a show called Neverland. And he would pretty much chase Neverland for the rest of his life. We'll get there eventually. As Meatloaf told it on VH1 Storytellers, he did that show in 1999, and he said that anytime Steinman wrote a song, it went into his massive Neverland folio, and he kept adding to this giant opus for years and years and years. But as that process was beginning, Meatloaf and Steinman felt that 3 of the Neverland songs were exceptional, and they started to develop that into an album. The songs were Heaven Can Wait, All Revved Up with No Place to Go, which actually existed under a different title at that time, and Bat Out of Hell. So they write this album, and they begin recording this album in 1975. And as they go through that process, they shop the album around to record labels, and they get rejected. And they shop it to new labels, and they get rejected. And this happens over and over and over. And as Meatloaf tells it in his autobiography, this goes on for 2.5 years. Record executives had a difficult time understanding Steinman's brand of over-the-top theatrical rock, you know, and it didn't seem to help that they had members of Bruce Springsteen's E Street Band playing on the record. Like, they still didn't get it. You know, you had some heavy hitters on there, and the sound at times was very Bruce Springsteen-inspired even, but the labels just couldn't really see the vision. And Clive Davis himself even asked Steinman if he'd ever heard a rock and roll record because of the unorthodox way he'd write songs. And which, you know, Meatloaf, it pissed Meatloaf off, but he says Steinman just laughed it off. He didn't care. So they forged ahead, and Steinman kept adding what would come to be known as his trademark bombast to the record. I like that word. I will use it quite a bit when I talk about, you know, Steinman's song sound and style. Meatloaf joked that new record labels were being formed and founded just to reject this album. But eventually, they get a deal at Cleveland International Records with the help of Steven Van Zandt from the E Street Band. And even then, almost everybody at the parent company, which was Epic Records, hated the thing. Steinman says he was going for a timeless sound that didn't adhere to trends and would therefore be out of place no matter when it was released. And if you listen to Bat Out of Hell, you will hear that. I mean, there are parts of that record that sound like it could be from the 50s. There are parts of that record that sound like, you know, something that Phil Spector would have done maybe in the 60s with the Ronettes. I don't know. It's just, it's kind of, when I first heard it, it was difficult for me to place it. I was like, this is 77. This is so close to, I mean, you've already got Black Sabbath at that time. You've had Black Sabbath for almost 10 years, and this is so close to new wave, and punk is a thing. But it was hard for me to wrap my head around the fact that that album came out at that time. And I guess that's kind of what Steinman was going for. And so it was released on October 21, 1977, to mixed reviews and reception. But those who loved it really loved it, and it went platinum the following year. And by 2001, it had sold 14 million copies. So yeah, I think all the labels that rejected it probably wound up eating a nice hot steaming plate of crow for that. But anyway, 3 of its singles went top 40. You had Paradise by the Dashboard Light, you had Took the Words Right Out of My Mouth, and 2 Out of 3 Ain't Bad, which just fell short of cracking the top 10. On July 8th, 1978, it peaked at 11, but it spent a respectable 23 weeks on the chart, and that's okay. They would give it another go in 1993, like I said, and we will get there. So where do Steinman and Meatloaf go from Bat Out of Hell? Well, you do a follow-up album, of course. I mean, you know, you got a big success, you want to strike while the iron's hot, and you want to get another one out there, but there's a problem with that.
Meatloaf's voice was in shambles because the dude had been touring extensively. He'd been singing the way he did at that level. You know, the way he makes the sounds that his voice could make night after night. And as we'll see, by the end of his career, he's going to barely have any voice left. Not to mention the drug habit that he had found along the way. So Meatloaf was a bit exhausted. And I don't mean he was tired. I mean his resources, his abilities had been used up when it came time to record the follow-up album. So they try several times to record some of the new songs that Steinman has, but the results just aren't good. And by now, guess who really wants a Bat Out of Hell record? The label does. So they actually convinced Jim Steinman to record the vocals himself and release the follow-up under his own name. Originally, the album was going to be called Renegade Angel, but by the time it surfaced in April 1981, it was called Bad for Good. And it had a lot of the same musicians playing on it as Bat Out of Hell. A similar cover painting that was very fantastic and epic looking by Richard Corbin, who had done the first album. And I'll be honest, I don't think it's a bad album. It's not Meatloaf. And I'll tell you, I've always thought that Steinman sings in a very similar way to Meatloaf. But it's almost like a Meatloaf light. It's like he doesn't have the projection and the over-the-top abilities that Meatloaf has. Some of the vibrato and just some of the theatrics that Meatloaf can pull off, Steinman cannot do. But he can hold his own on the material. And I do enjoy the album. It's just not Meatloaf. He would get a top 40 single out of it. Rock and Roll Dreams Come Through was actually on that album first, and it went to number 32. But Meatloaf's version would hit about 20 positions higher when they put it out again in 1994 off of Bat Out of Hell 2. And Bad for Good, the album, goes to number 63 on Billboard. But it ain't Meatloaf, and it ain't Bat Out of Hell. But speak of the devil, guess who's been working hard to get clean and sober, get healthy, work out, get his stamina up, and get back out there and perform again? Meatloaf has. And so the letdown of the album falling apart motivated him, and he's back to his old self again by 1981. So Steinman took 7 songs, including the title track from the More Than You Deserve musical, the one that they put in for Meatloaf to sing. They go back in the studio with Meatloaf, and they record the Dead Ringer album, which comes out on September 4th, 1981. So Meatloaf and Jim Steinman have a proper Meatloaf and Steinman album out in the stores in 1981. And that album goes to number 45 on Billboard, though it does hit number 1 in the UK. And only one track, the song I'm Gonna Love Her for Both of Us, goes to number 84 on the Billboard Hot 100. The rest don't chart. And to add insult to injury, after a song called Read 'Em and Weep fails to get any traction, Barry Manilow re-records it in 1983 and goes to number 18 with it. So what went wrong with Dead Ringer? Why did it not work out? It was, in my opinion, a matter of timing. Like I said, the iron was hot after Bat Out of Hell, but the boys could not both strike at the same time. So instead of a proper follow-up to Bat Out of Hell, we got 2 albums that were both missing something important. Steinman's was missing Meatloaf, and Meatloaf's was missing the songs that Steinman had intended for that moment. It just wasn't their time. Yet. Yet. Steinman would go on to have a pretty successful 1980s, charting huge hits with artists like Bonnie Tyler, Air Supply, like I said, Barry Manilow, and even Barbara Streisand sang some of his songs. Bonnie Tyler, my God, holding out for a hero from the Footloose soundtrack? Are you kidding me? That song was everywhere, as was Making Love Out of Nothing at All for Air Supply. And Bonnie Tyler herself would even re-record that one several years later. And, you know, Jim Steinman's songs were very much in fashion now after Bat Out of Hell, so the record labels got it, and they wanted these people singing these songs. And these songs were successful. Meatloaf, not as much. Man, he put out 4 albums that year. That included the Dead Ringer album. But these albums either didn't chart in the U.S., or they charted much lower than people expected, but only boosted because they contained some of Steinman's songs. Like Bad Attitude came out in 1984, but it only had 2 songs by Steinman on it, and it stalled at 74. Albums called Midnight at the Lost and Found and Blind Before I Stop had no Steinman songs, and they never appeared on the charts. And we can only assume that Meatloaf did go blind in 1986, because after that album, he was radio silent for years. It made total sense that someone like me, who lived for music at that time, but who was not alive in the 70s and wouldn't remember Bat Out of Hell. When I first heard his name in the early 90s, I could only ask, who?
I mean, he disappeared for a while. And the other thing, the two men had financial and legal disputes throughout the 80s. It was your typical frontman versus songwriter type stuff, you know. Meatloaf's known for singing the songs. Steinman writes them, but he's not properly getting credit. So, you know, they would bicker, they would argue kind of publicly at times. But the two men actually wound up getting together at Steinman's Connecticut home in Christmas 1990. And as Meatloaf described it, Steinman played the piano and Meatloaf sang Bat Out of Hell, the song, and right there in Steinman's home. And something sparked that day. It was like when the Grinch's heart grew three sizes in that cartoon. The boys started feeling re-energized, and they started feeling reinvigorated, and they started talking about what they could do next. And before you know it, they were back at it, and the duo was finally working on a proper Bat Out of Hell 2 album with the subtitle Back Into Hell. And that would ultimately come out on September 14, 1993. And this one was an instant success and would go three times platinum just by the end of 1993 alone, with millions more sales on the way. Like I said, it was everywhere. You couldn't turn on radio or MTV without hearing it. There was a very visible Beauty and the Beast-inspired music video that went with the first single, I Would Do Anything for Love, But I Won't Do That. And they re-recorded three of the songs that had been on Bad for Good. So we finally got Meatloaf's proper vocal on some of those tracks, as well as two from the 1989 Pandora's Box album, Original Sin, that Steinman had produced for a female pop group that he had put together. And the rest were songs that were put on this earth by Jim Steinman for this exact moment and album. Because let me tell you, if you haven't heard it, Bat Out of Hell 2 is a freaking masterpiece. I love it more than Bat Out of Hell 1 by far. And that's not to say anything negative about Bat Out of Hell. When I say that, I'm not crapping on those songs. Bat Out of Hell is a wonderful album. There's nothing on there I hate. I don't dislike any of it. But Bat Out of Hell 2 is just rock and roll perfection. Oh my God, there's a song called Everything Louder Than Everything Else that I, to this day, wonder why that wasn't released as a single. It's so good. Anyway, it was propelled by three top 40 singles, including the number one, I Would Do Anything for Love, which went number one in 28 countries. And you had MTV playing it like the VJ got a free hand job every time they aired it. It was all over radio. And regardless of the fact that the album version was 12 minutes long, it still got played and played and played. And people still, 32 years later, ask, what the hell is the that Meatloaf won't do for love? What is that? What is it that Meatloaf won't do for love? I've got the answer right here on WNET Talk after these messages, so don't go away.
Yo, this is Jimmy Koo from the world of rock, and you're listening to WNUT going nuts.
Kids playing radio. For 30 years, WNUT.
You are back on WNUT Talk, where we are talking about the partnership between Jim Steinman and Meatloaf. Handed to us by God, songwriting and performing team that made rock and roll perfection for 40 years, and I am not even playing. Man, and like I said before the break, people still ask today, from 1993, they've been asking, what is the that Meatloaf won't do for love? I would do anything for love, but I won't do that. People say, what is that? And there's all kinds of funny little jokes and shit. Well, let's break it down here, because every chorus has a line that tells you specifically what that is. And if you still don't know, you haven't listened to the damn song. First chorus, there's a line that says, but I'll never forget the way you feel right now. I would do anything for love, but I won't do that. I will never forget the way you feel right now. The second chorus is, I'll never forgive myself if we don't go all the way tonight. It's a little personal, Meatloaf, but hey, if you want to put your business out there that way, more power to you. The third chorus says, but I'll never do it better than I do it with you. I'll do anything for love, but I won't do that. Fourth chorus, I'll never stop dreaming of you every night of my life. See, that's sweet. But anyway, Lorraine Crosby, when she kicks in at the end, she sings, after a while, you'll forget everything. It was a brief interlude and a midsummer night's fling, and you'll see that it's time to move on. And Meatloaf says, I won't do that. He won't do what she just said. And then she says, I know the territory. I've been around. It'll all turn to dust and we'll all fall down. Sooner or later, you'll be screwing around. And Meatloaf says again, I won't do that. Those are the things that he won't do. They're right there in the song. So if you don't know by now, hopefully you can go spread the word
inform the public, let people know what he won't do for love. But anyway, so we were just talking about Bat Out of Hell 2. What happened after that album? Well, Meatloaf would sprinkle Jim Steinman songs into anything he released throughout the 90s, with a couple on Welcome to the Neighborhood, that originally done by Steinman on Bad for Good, and he had a few on the very best of Meatloaf, including two that Steinman had co-written with Andrew Lloyd Webber from the Whistle Down the Wind musical. And this time, Meatloaf managed to stay pretty visible, still around. And he, like I said, he even did the VH1 Storytellers in 1999. So the public did not forget about him. He did not go radio silent like he had in the late 80s. Steinman kept working, having songs recorded by Taylor Dane and Boyzone and even Celine Dion, who scored a massive hit with It's All Coming Back to Me Now, which was originally from the Pandora's Box album that I mentioned earlier, Original Sin. And he kept working in the theater. The Andrew Lloyd Webber collab Whistle Down the Wind opened in 1996, and he did one called Tanz der Vampire, or Dance of the Vampire, in 1997, which I've heard mixed things about. Some people hate it. Some people seem to go, hey, it's freaking great. And at one point, he even began working on a stage musical of Batman. Yes, that Batman that would never open, although we would hear a couple of the songs from it soon enough, and we'll get there. But the guys would have a falling out that was several years kind of brewing. First, Steinman registered a trademark on the name Bat Out of Hell in 1995, which wasn't entirely unreasonable, except that Meatloaf's biggest successes as a performer were under that title. So Meatloaf was, you know, kind of salty about that, and he was like, well, that limits me. And he's also a little salty with Steinman after Celine Dion recorded It's All Coming Back to Me Now in 1996, when he claimed the song had been promised to him. Steinman actually filed and won a court case preventing Meatloaf from recording that song, which I didn't even think was possible because of compulsory licensing. But hey, it's rare that anything surprises me anymore. I don't know the inner workings of how that decision was arrived at, but it was. And you know, Meatloaf couldn't record that song. But he would get a victory of his own later when he sued Steinman for the right to use the Bat Out of Hell title, and he also sought $100 million that he felt was owed from Steinman and Steinman's manager, who settled out of court, and they allowed Meatloaf to use the title for a third Bat Out of Hell album, and to release new recordings of some of Steinman's songs on that album, including It's All Coming Back to Me Now. So hey, everything worked out, right? No, they kind of still didn't like each other. And Bat Out of Hell 3 came out on October 20th, 2006, but it was a bit of a misstep because, you know, like I said, the guys had fallen out. Steinman was not involved in the recording of the album. He did not ensure the production did justice to his trademark, like I say, bombastic style. And they padded the album out with songs by Desmond Child and Diane Warren and others. And so, you know, Bat Out of Hell 3 just became another album of professionally written songs, which we had been drowning in since the 90s. And yeah, it was sweet to hear Meatloaf finally taking on seven Steinman songs we hadn't heard him sing yet, but the highlight for me by far is his version of Bad for Good with Brian May of Queen on guitar. Holy shit. That song is worth the price of admission for that album alone. And we got to hear Meatloaf sing two songs from the never-realized Batman musical, The Very Jagged and The Land of the Pig, The Butcher is King, and the more tender Cry to Heaven, which I like, but Meatloaf went a little over the top on the warbling vocals. If he had done it a little more reserved, Cry to Heaven would probably be one of my favorite tracks from that album. A couple other Meatloaf albums did come out without Steinman's involvement, including 2010's Hang Cool Teddy Bear, which has about the dumbest album title I've ever heard in my life, but it is by far my favorite Meatloaf album that Steinman was not involved in. I shit you not, it's a very fun record. It has songs written by heavy hitters across the rock and roll spectrum. And there's one called California Isn't Big Enough that I played on WNUT's Friday Vibing episode back in 2023 that is still absolutely one of my favorite songs he's ever done that wasn't Steinman. It was written by Justin Hawkins from The Darkness, and it just makes me wonder what a full album of collaboration between Meatloaf and Hawkins could have been like. But anyway, Steinman, over in his world, turned his attention, of course, back to Neverland, which had been reworked into Bat Out of Hell, the musical. So the Dream Engine became Neverland, Neverland became Bat Out of Hell, the musical, and finally, Steinman seemed to realize the lifelong work he'd been picking away at steadily ever since 1968 at Amherst College. Seriously, the story of Bat Out of Hell, the musical, is so grandiose. so epic in scale, so many twists and turns. I recommend just looking into that. God, I could do a WNET talk just on the history of that show, but I won't. But anyway, check it out if you're interested. We are going to talk about the payoff here at the end of the episode. But first, Jim and Meat had one more album in them. They reconciled their differences once and for all, and the last album Meatloaf ever made and released was called Braver Than We Are. It came out on September 9th, 2016, and it had full involvement from Jim Steinman, who wrote every song on it. And it should have been a triumph. It should have been a cleansing. It should have been a reclamation of the crown that no one else is worthy to wear. But by 2016, Meatloaf's voice was down to a shell of its former power and its former glory. It was raspy. It had lost its bombast. And throughout the album, Meatloaf is singing mostly in his lower registers, which is not where his voice historically lived. And not only that, but it clearly sounded in a lot of places, like several takes were being combined, like that maybe the producer was taken line by line or even word by word and putting some of Meatloaf's best takes into full verses just to get him through these songs. And even though it sounds sometimes like his voice is no longer under his own control, there are moments where it does soar and you get a glimpse of the old Meatloaf still lurking somewhere in there, like on the song Souvenirs, which was from that More Than You Deserve musical. I think at the same time, it is cathartic and heartbreaking to hear that album, but ultimately I'm glad they made it. I really am. It's somehow a fitting encore to both of their careers. One last go at it. Balls to the wall, ravaged voice and all, you know, getting together and just making the art that they loved like they had been doing together since 1973. Plus, it reunited Meatloaf with Ellen Foley from Paradise by the Dashboard Light after 40 years. So there's some really cool moments. And the album represents something bigger than the fact that he couldn't do it like he used to be able to do it. So, you know, proceed cautiously. Check it out if you're interested. The songs are great. Well, most of them. But, you know, they're not performed the way he could have done it if they had decided to make this album in, say, 2005 or 6 when Bat Out of Hell 3 came out instead. But it also wouldn't have represented what it does if they had. But whatever happened with Bat Out of Hell the musical? Well, as I mentioned, the show that had begun its life as the Dream Engine reached its final form as Bat Out of Hell the musical. And it was full of songs that came from throughout Steinman's career and from various projects, which some people dismissed as lazy. When that show finally opened, they said, oh, look, he's just putting popular chart-topping songs in this. You know, it's a jukebox musical. But remember, Meatloaf said in his VH1 Storyteller's performance that anytime Steinman wrote a song, it went into this show, which at that time was called Neverland, but it was this show. So arguably, it's the other way around. Arguably, artists had been covering this musical for decades while the public still hadn't seen it. Bat Out of Hell, the musical, would finally open in the UK in 2017. It would go to Canada and Germany in 2018. And it would get an off-Broadway run at New York City Center in the summer of 2019. And I actually flew up to see it from South Carolina. It was well attended. I thought it was great. It got good publicity, though some of the reviewers were a little perplexed by it at the time. But overall, it was a very fun show. It was often described as a bit of a fever dream of rock and roll and, you know, full of excess and, yes, some rock and roll tropes, you know. But Meatloaf was even there. He attended the New York show. He gushed over his dear friend finally realizing this dream after nearly 50 years in the making and, you know, painstakingly toiling away at it and making demos and shopping it and, you know, failed attempts to bring it to the stage and workshopping it at the Kennedy Center in 77 and stuff like that. And on August 20th, 2019, Meatloaf even appeared on stage during the curtain call and he sang You Took the Words Right Out of My Mouth with the cast. And in my opinion, he sounded stronger there than he had on Braver Than We Are just 3 years before. It was a very cool moment. You can see that on YouTube, so look that up. I encourage it. I might even put it in the description of this show wherever you might be hearing it. Now, of course, you know, the next year we had the COVID pandemic, so nobody was really doing anything. People were still putting out records, but very slowly because studio time was harder to get and maintain, and nobody was touring, and so a lot of musical projects, especially you know, with older musicians and writers, just kind of were stalling, and people weren't really doing much. And unfortunately, the next news that we got was that Steinman died of kidney failure at Danbury Hospital in Connecticut on April 19th, 2021. He was 73 years old, and Steinman's health had been declining for some time. He'd even suffered a stroke 4 years before that, but on his death, Meatloaf said of his longtime friend and collaborator, "We didn't just know each other, we were each other." And that summed up the relationship that they had had, warts and all, you know, feuds and reconciliations. They were not just brothers. They were two parts of the same coin, man. And Meatloaf made sure that people knew that when we lost Steinman. And then 9 months later, on January 20th, 2022, Meatloaf died at a hospital in Nashville, Tennessee. Reporting from TMZ and social media posts by his daughter on Instagram before he died heavily suggested that Meatloaf died of COVID-19, but no cause of death was officially released to the public. Meatloaf had been very vocally against COVID-19 restrictions, calling them political, and saying, quote, "If I die, I die, but I'm not going to be controlled," unquote. He was 74 years old, and just as their birth dates were separated by a mere month, their deaths were only 9 months apart. They truly were two halves of the same force. And let me tell you, going back and researching this and listening to this music again and rediscovering how much I love this partnership that lasted some 40-odd years, I honestly count myself lucky that I existed on this planet at the same time as this force in rock and roll songwriting and performance. And I highly encourage you, especially if all you know is Bat Out of Hell or Bat Out of Hell 2 or, you know, a few of these songs. Maybe you didn't know that Holding Out for a Hero was written by Steinman, or you didn't know that Air Supply's Making Love Out of Nothing at All was by him. If something in this episode has gotten your interest up, go seek this stuff out. Dive in like I did, man. Let this stuff wash over you, because there is some great work that Steinman put out with and without Meatloaf. But the two of them together, when they were on the same page and they were working towards a goal and putting music out, my God, they were unstoppable. And they were a force not only to be reckoned with, but just a force to be witnessed. And after reliving these stories and songs I could barely recall, it's all coming back to me now. And hey, if you're holding out for a hero, might I suggest you'll find some great ones on WNUT. You can listen to the flagship show on our YouTube channel at The Real WNUT, or you can listen free streaming 24 hours a day on live365.com or the Live365 app. All you do is you search WNUT on that platform and boom, you're right there. For WNUT Talk, this is Brandon, a.k.a. Stoney, saying, hey, if you thought we weren't coming back with a new episode, we would do anything for love, but we won't do that. We will see you next time.